This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is Afternoons on Dubai Eye 103.8.
I'm Helen Farmer. Great to have you with us on today's show. We're in conversation with career coach, recruiter, author Hamza Zuali, who says stop chasing that dream job and start building that dream life, telling you how and taking your questions. Dr. Thurai, clinical psychologist, explains why and how marriage counselling can work and when it doesn't. Wonder with Nada keeping us busy around town over the weekend, and the students from Jumeirah College doing their part for Earth Day. We have stolen away a very busy man for the next hour. Delighted to have Hamza Zuali here. He is a career coach, a seasoned recruiter with more than two decades of experience here in the Middle East and Europe as well. He has recruited hundreds of candidates across all sorts of different job sectors and indeed stages. He's worked with multinationals, SMEs, public sectors. He understands hiring managers and how they evaluate candidates and how HR works too. He's also an accomplished author, having written the award-winning book, The 30-Day Job Search, which has been a bestseller on Amazon several times. He's an entrepreneur, he's an employer, and he's on hand to help us. How are you this afternoon, sir?
Very good, thank you.
I feel like we're going to have a busy hour. To be honest, judging by messages I've had on social media and indeed on 4001. And before we get to the text line and indeed our topic of the hour, which is about changing a mindset around finding that dream job and instead looking at building a dream life, I'm curious to get your read on the job market right now, Hamza. What's your kind of ear to the ground hearing?
It's definitely busy. We've been hoping that Ramadan is a bit slower for us with the shorter hours, but we've been so busy. So that's fantastic, actually. You know, coming out from the previous 2 years, it's nice to finally have a job market where, you know, that actually we are being sent again to look for candidates elsewhere than the UAE, which is a really strong sign that, you know, there's a lot of demand. So that's good.
Any particular industry sectors or indeed levels that are, you know, particularly fire right now?
It's across the board. I didn't see anything. I mean, we're dealing with government companies. We're dealing with banking sector. We're dealing with multinationals, and I didn't see any sector kind of lagging behind. I think the economy is forecasted to do really, really well, and as always, the sort of job sector is following that very, very closely. So I think that people are just getting ready to a strong 2024 by hiring today. So
bring it on. So job seekers market or an employer's market right now, do you think?
It depends on the skill. It will always depend on the skill. There's always going to be, so we do a lot of memorization, for example. That's always going to be a candidate market. Mm-hmm. That's always going to be a job seekers market. But the higher you go, the more specialized you are, and the more likely you go the other side of the fence and become a candidate market, be part of the candidate market. So
we're talking more and more across all different topics of the show, and indeed the schedule here on Dubai Eye 103.8 about Chat GPT, about AI. And I'm curious in terms of where you're seeing it being implemented, whether that is how you find a job, how, you know, recruiters are using it, are people using it for cover letters, and are there any jobs that you think are going to be perhaps on their way out as a result of it?
You know, I think there's a misunderstanding of AI and how it's going to affect the job sector, the job market. I don't think it's going to replace anyone, at least for the next 10 years. The reason I say this is that AI, or Chat GPT for that specific example, is like having a second brain. It's like having a secretary. It's like having someone to bounce ideas off. It's like just an opportunity to get better. You know, these questions that you don't want to nag at asking so many questions that your mentor, your manager, your team members, because they're busy. Well, guess what? Chat GPT is free and available and never gets upset. So I think the what's happening is that people are going to be much better at their job. So, even today, instead of sending an email and hoping that it will be kind of received the right way, well, ask Chat GPT, do you see any potential issues? How can it be read? How would you rewrite it? Take a contract, for example. I've done so many things with Chat GPT, and I've asked it to I've asked it to write a contract, and I wasn't happy. because when ChatGPT writes a contract by itself, even if you explain a lot of things before, it doesn't necessarily do a good job. You need to customize it and work with it, which is really that synergy mm-hmm. that you want to achieve.
So it's going to give you the foundation, but you then apply your decades of experience exactly. to finesse it.
And you're only going to get a different sort of opinion, different angle. It's going to be much, much richer. So
collaboration. Mm. Interesting. Okay. Now we're talking today about how you can build your dream life instead of focusing on necessarily finding your dream job. Do you think we kind of put this dream job on a pedestal and kind of fetishize it? And that is the be all end all when it comes to our lives.
Too much. It's really too much. There's so many reasons why this way of thinking about your career is a wrong one. Career is part of life, okay? So when you think about a dream job, you suddenly put one job above all other jobs. Or sometimes you put one job at a certain company or certain type of company above all of the other jobs. The thing with humans is that we have brains that are super adaptive. We can actually enjoy so many different things. And when we think about that dream job, we stop the brain from that beautiful, you know, ability to adapt, to enjoy other things. We just become obsessed with that thing. Now, do we know that this job is actually going to make us happy?
Yeah, because, or is it just the promise of this job?
Isn't it, right? We always see a dream job from the outside, right? We seek a dream job from the outside. We don't really know. We haven't got it yet.
It's a bit like dating.
It's a little bit like that.
When you see someone, you know, and it's that, I'm going to try and not be crude, but it's like, you know, show me a beautiful woman and I'll show you a man who's bored of waking up next to her. You know what I mean? No one or nothing is ever as good or indeed as bad.
Absolutely.
As it seems at first.
And on top of this, we are constantly evolving and changing. Like when I was in my 20s, I was very different than when I was in my 30s, and I'm very different now. I don't like the same thing. I don't enjoy the same thing. I don't even look for the same things. I think this idea of a dream job is dangerous, and I use the word dangerous because suddenly it makes you completely ignore opportunities that could be in front of you.
You're blinkered.
Oh, of course, for sure. You completely, you know, focus on that potential dream job. But the reality is, is it really what you're looking for? Do you know this job? And finally, in order to actually have, let's say, a dream job, well, you need to be good at something. Mm-hmm. And that undermines the entire process of becoming good at something first in order to get a dream job. And unfortunately today, who you know, I speak to sometimes to universities and students want a dream job. You need to go through the
stuff first.
Exactly. Exactly.
Sure.
You can't be Lionel Messi without the training, mm-hmm. the sweat, the
graft, the
et cetera,
hard work.
Et cetera. Yeah. And I think we're ignoring that. And as a recruiter, the challenge that I have is that sometimes I would come with, oh, here's an opportunity, but people are, you know, already made their mind up that that's not what I'm my dream is, you know, and I said, but hang on, you know, you're gonna literally learn from probably some of the best people in that specific industry. They are a small organization, but they do well. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I want a bigger organization, you know, a multinational, like a brand, like this, like that, but you're just literally putting yourself in a box, and that's mm-hmm. so dangerous.
Hamza Dhuali is a career coach, a recruiter, an author, and he's on hand today for your live career clinic. He says, stop searching for a dream job and build a dream life instead. That sounds nice. How?
So understanding that, you know, one of the most important components of life is to actually, you know, juggle with different balls without letting any of them mm-hmm. fall. Career is one of them, but it's just one. It's just one. You know, your family is another one. Your friends is another one. Your health is another one. And I think that's what life is made for. If I was an evil capitalist, you know, I would say, no, focus on your career, dream job. Yes. Forget about everything else. Well, I think that's a failed life. that's a sad, fad life. I think that, you know, a job, if you are able to live with a roof over your head, to feed the people you love, to care for them, to enjoy going on holiday, if you're able to be stimulated intellectually, to build a social life, to get to know people, my God, you already have a dream job. You're better off than 90% of the population on Earth. And it's amazing. You know, if you're not worried about how the end of the month looks like, I mean, that's an amazing achievement. And I think cultivating gratitude and really putting things back into context is very, very important. You know, you can't just be successful at your job if you don't see your kids.
Mm-hmm.
What's the point, if that makes sense?
That's so refreshing to hear, that reframing. It really is. Hamza, we're going to go to the text line, and we've had a couple of anonymous messages and a couple of names messages. So Neil has been in touch saying, curious to get your guest's take on this. I'm toying with the idea of Saudi for 2 years maximum. However, I worry about coming back into the UAE market in terms of matching salary. Do you think it can be done? I'm in construction.
Yes, yes, yes. Look, the simple truth is that everything changes all the time. So what's true today might not be true in 2 years. We don't know what's going to happen with the market. But if you have a good opportunity in Saudi, I don't think you should be worried about what happens after Saudi. This is something that, you know, there's something about too much planning. That's too much planning right there. If you have an amazing opportunity that you feel not only can give you a good financial income, but also boost your career, give you a much better experience, perhaps, mm-hmm. than if you stay here, then that acts also as an investment. So the more specialized you become, the way salaries work is that, you know, oftentimes I work with clients, companies, employers that give me a budget. They say, we're looking for XYZ. This is the budget. Guess what? I find a superstar, but he wants more. And guess what happens in, let's say, 50, 60% of the time? Well, they seek special approval. They go up to the CEO and they say, really, he's special. And I think that as long as you're becoming better and better at your job, you're on the right track. But too much planning would give you paralysis, if that makes sense.
Sounds like you need to take this chance, Neil. Mm. All right, I hope that helps. Anonymous message come in for Hamza on 4001. Don't forget, you can leave your name off. We're here through until 5 o'clock, taking your questions in the live career clinic. No Name says, last week I was passed over for promotion and pay rise, and the way our company is structured, it's going to be a year until the opportunity comes up again. I feel like this is a pretty clear message about how they see me and my future in that company. I enjoy the role, but a lot of people left after getting their bonus, and my workload has massively increased as a result. I've asked for some feedback, but I think it might be time to leave. Any insights? So crossroads here, it sounds like.
I think, if the situation happened to me, I would be a little bit emotional. I could be saying similar things as well. I think if we look at things in a different way, if we say to ourselves, okay, a pay rise is prepared months before. A pay rise is prepared months before. You can't just wait and say, well, I'm next in line. I should normally get it. I mean, I didn't get it for 3 years. Normally it's my turn. Well, maybe some companies do that. But in reality, we've got to work on ourselves. I think the more we say to ourselves, okay, here's a question that I would say, if this person was my best friend, I would go to the management, to the people that decide that. And I would say, hey, what would it take for me to get XYZ? What would I need to do to get XYZ by 3 months from now or 6 months from now? If they say, well, you got to wait for another year, I would say, well, I already did and nothing happened. So I'd like to make sure we don't find ourselves in a similar situation.
I'm sure I'm doing everything in my power to be proactive and, you know, that I'm ticking boxes from myself.
100%. I think the other thing as well is that pay is one thing. And it's really what this person is saying is that I don't feel recognized. This
exactly.
is what she's saying. It's lack of recognition. It's not about the money. I don't think she cares about the actual number. It's about, I'm working really, really hard and I don't feel recognized. Whereas if I see others maybe not working that hard, but why are they getting the bonuses or the pay rise? Mm-hmm. So, and I think that that's a fair approach. That's a fair thought, but it could be emotional a little bit. And we are emotional beings. I'm not saying that negatively at all. But I think, look, the number one thing to decide whether the person should leave or not, there's three words that we need to remember. It's autonomy, mastery, and purpose. If your job gives you these three words, these three feelings, you're in the right job.
Can you unpack them for us?
Sure. Autonomy, is someone telling you what to do all the time, or are you able to organize your job to make your job unique? So if you compare two similar jobs, so they are the same. Okay, job description exactly the same, but made by two people. The beautiful thing about jobs is that they are going to be different because of the people. And if you're able to have the autonomy to design your job the way you want, because the purpose of a job description is getting results. But if you're able to get the same results
in your way,
then you have this freedom. You're in tune with your own personality, your own views, your own thoughts, your own ideas, etc. Mastery is really, you know, how good do you feel about your job? So for me, I'm a recruiter. So I feel that I'm, you know, I say this to myself, but only to myself in my mirror.
And the radio.
I say, I'm the best recruiter ever on earth. I'm the best. I sometimes repeat this. You're lucky. You're working with the best recruiter on earth. Of course, there's better than me, way better than me. But my point is, I enjoy the feeling of mastery, like someone, like a chef would enjoy the feeling of mastering so many beautiful, high-level recipes. Mm-hmm. And like a painter. The mastery is the difference between a job and when your job becomes an art. When you look at it and you say, damn, that's good.
And taking pride.
Exactly. You're proud of it. So that's mastery. When you feel like that, when you go home, you feel, I'm doing an incredible job. I'm an ordinary person that does an extraordinary job.
And that's enough to be a big job. It can be being part of something amazing and doing your best and doing it well.
Absolutely. And in the old English language, an art is a job. In the old English language, people would say, I know my art, i.e. I know my job. Mm-hmm. I know how to do this. But it reaches the level of art when people, you know, when you stand and you say, oh, that's a beautiful email. Honestly, these emails that you write are beautiful. Yes, it's not just the email. It's working on your craft so much, and you feel that progress.
Exactly. You recognize the improvement
Absolutely.
In yourself. And what's the third, Hamza?
So purpose, because you want to feel like you're part of something bigger than just the doing of the job, right? You know, you don't want to, if one of the job was just to put one brick in front of the other, on top of the other, like building something, you want to feel that you're building something exceptional. You know, you're part of something potentially historic. You're building a mosque, a cathedral. You are beautifying the city. You are making sure the city is going to attract so many tourists.
You're creating someone's home.
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. So when you feel that there is a purpose, and sometimes, don't get me wrong, the purpose can be internal to the company or your own purpose. My purpose is to put money aside and to buy my own house. That's a purpose. And when you are led by a purpose, no matter if, oh, but there's no vision in my company, that have your own purpose, you know? This is tying back to really building a dream life. And that's how it would make sense. If you have these three elements in a job, if you know why you're doing it, the purpose, if you know, you know, how to do it in such a way that you enjoy the absolute beauty you're creating every day, and if you're autonomous, you're able to be free in your head on how you're going to conduct and do it, then you shouldn't look at the salary just yet. You should fight for it, but not look for it.
What an answer. Thank you so much for that. And Anonymous, I really hope that's helped clarify your feelings and indeed maybe ask yourself a few questions before you pull the trigger. We've stolen away one of Dubai's most in-demand recruiters. Hamza Zawali is a career coach, recruiter with decades of experience. He's an author and entrepreneur, and he's answering my questions. But honestly, the text line, I think, is raising some really interesting questions, Hamza. So please don't hesitate to get in touch on 4001. We were just talking earlier about stop searching for that dream job or career and build a dream life instead. And Steph wants to know, how many people does Hamza think actually enjoy their jobs? What would you guess?
Look at it this way. So if you take a company that has 100 employees, if we assume that most people are not happy with their job. This means that the company is almost going to go bankrupt soon. As soon as these people are going to find jobs, they're going to go back. And it's not possible. I think that there's three stages. You've got people that are absolutely on the way out, looking for a job, actively looking. There's a serious reason behind it, and that's fantastic. You've got people that are happy, you know, content. It's not the dream job, but they are happy. They are content. It allows them to do what
boxes.
They want. Exactly. And you've got a huge bracket in the middle that has ups and downs and not necessarily overly joyed about working in that company, not overly joyed about their salary, not overly joyed about the distance that they have to do to go to work. And I think that what we have to realize is that we need to step back a little bit, to zoom out a little bit and to say, okay, this is, you know, the distance you're doing or the salary you're earning right now, you're gaining experience and you are giving yourself the opportunity to learn, to grow towards that mastery level. And I think that it's only a chapter, one chapter. So if you don't have any serious reason on why you should leave, I think you should work on how to be happy. Really, really important, because what happens is that our natural state, and you know what's the national sport in every company? Criticize your employer. Every single company has, okay, you have a manager, you have a director, hopefully not here. but
thank you for saving me from that.
You know, I tell you something, my team never knew, but I used to have access to their emails, and purely because people leave, people go, and I have to sometimes send emails for them, et cetera, and sometimes one of them would forget. And when I have to say, well, that wasn't a good move what you did, you can bet that there's going to be some emails at the time exchanged. Now it's by WhatsApp, so I have no way to know, but I know that they're typing on the national sport is criticizing. The national sport is finding some sort of negativity to discuss. And if we are able to reverse that, imagine if a company or for someone, instead of spending valuable time and energy thinking about why his life is not great, why he's been treated this way, he thinks about, How can I actually help them better? You know, I've coached people that have micromanagers that made life miserable for their people. And I've coached one of these employees and I've told him, look, go to him. It was a whole conversation, obviously, before that. I told him, go to him and ask him, listen, it looks like sometimes you're stressed and I'm not doing enough to reassure you. What else do you think I can do? Because I feel that you're always reminding me, following up with me. It makes me stressed. How can we reverse that so that you feel, oh my God, I don't need to do that. What can I do more? Change the conversation, change the mindset, if that makes sense.
This is a good topic on management styles for another day. a message here from F on 4001 saying, how to explain that you're in a toxic work environment in a job interview and that's the reason you're leaving a company?
Ooh, that's a tough one.
Isn't
that's
it?
A really tough
That's
one.
Why I wanted to put it to you.
Let me tell you, in hindsight, when you interview someone, you start with suspicion because, well, why is he leaving if he's that good? His employer should look after him. So why is he or she leaving? That doesn't make sense. I need to find out why is he or she leaving. A little bit like when someone sells his apartment or his car. Why are you selling? It's nice. You have a beautiful view. Why are you selling? And we want to find the reason because our mind can rest. Mm-hmm. So whenever we're going to talk about problems, this is very, very dangerous because you're either a problem solver or you're going to bring these problems with you. If it's a toxic environment, it's due to the people that are working there, not necessarily just the management. This is very important. It's a team effort, whether for better or worse, it's a team effort. Okay. And what's important is to really be able to, if you describe an environment that doesn't fit with your personality, I wouldn't use negative words like toxic, but I would probably say, listen, the way I enjoy working is XYZ. This is where, if you look at my previous companies, I was top performance here, and here I never been able to spread my wings and to become that. And I think the environment is not just the right one for me. Great people always say positive things, but you know, the way they work works for them. Beautiful. But you know, I want to connect with my past success on every single company I've had.
Okay. Oh, I like that. Okay. F, I hope that helps. And all the best with the interview. Anonymous message here saying, how can I regain my boss's trust? Here's the situation. I was asked to be on a project outside of my team, and my boss thinks I colluded with the other manager to get put on the project, even though both of us have told him that the other team came to me out of the blue. Is there any way to rebuild?
I think the key question here is to understand what the problem is exactly, because the fact that he, the word colluded, the fact that he conspired or colluded or whatever, is it against that manager, or what does it change for that manager? I'd like more data in order to really answer correctly. But essentially, I would have a one-on-one conversation with the manager and say, okay, listen, what is the problem exactly? How do you feel that I did that? Do you feel I betrayed you? I went behind your back and I should have gone through you first? Mm-hmm. Or if that's the case, I promise you I'm going to do that next time.
If you felt undermined by how this unfolded, then I can only apologize and I can only tell you what actually happened. But now I know.
And please tell me how you'd like me to react next time it happens. But look, I'm trying to do the best I can. Inevitably, people are going to come to me for help. People are going to come to me for support. Should I just say no to them? Should I just speak to you first? Just tell me and let's put this behind us. Mm-hmm. And I think let's finish this, because it's unless you understand what's really behind, it's very hard to advise.
Okay, I hope that helps. A message here saying, hi guys, very interesting discussion. In my case, I lost my job as a sales manager and struggling to get a similar role due to lack of bachelor's degree. Is there a chance for high school graduates to land managerial roles in the UAE nowadays? Thank you. What's your take, Hamza?
You know, for many jobs, I would say no. For many jobs, you need a bachelor's degree nowadays to get, a job that you want to have a certain level of pay, et cetera, et cetera. But not for sales. Not for sales. One of my best friends, he's a super, super successful person. He only has his A level, but he's really high in a multinational. And just now, as we speak now, we are placing someone that is at EVP level in a bank in the UAE, doesn't have a bachelor's degree. I think it's you. It's your experience. There's a moment in life where your bachelor is more important. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's your, let's say, up until 25, 26 years old. But after that, transitioning towards experience matters more. And I think that one should look at, you know, if you ask me, for example, do I care for a salesperson to have, or sales manager, sales director, to have a bachelor's degree? Oh my God, no.
No, we want to you know, quantifiable
Absolutely.
Information can
what
we
What can
share
you do for me? Exactly. What can you do for me? You know, show me that you can do, for sales, show me the money. Show me what you did for others. Mm-hmm. Because yes, make me want to have the same. But I really don't care if you don't have a whatever certificate or whatever. Now, some jobs, you need that. You know, a nurse without a bachelor,
exactly.
Et cetera, et cetera. That's fine.
But not sales.
Not sales.
So I'm going to squeeze in one last question, and maybe you can help this listener. Saying, where are the best places to look for jobs? This listener says she's 26, female in marketing, but maybe let's park that and just talk in general terms. We've got 2 minutes. I'm like, can you give anyone, I know, can you give anyone who's currently looking for a job or a new job some good advice on where to go?
I think in life in general, in a job search, but as part of life, you have two ways to look at it. Either you attract things or you run after things. You're either a magnet and you become attractive, magnetic, or you run after things and you send CVs and it doesn't necessarily come. Mm-hmm. I think that the question entails that there is a place where there are jobs. It's probably a secret place, a website, and that's not how it works. I think the most important thing that you can do is to become attractive. Mm-hmm. There are at least 1,000 people like me in Dubai only, at least 2,000-3,000 to be honest, but at least 1,000 going through databases, LinkedIn every single day, looking for people, because that's how they make a living. That's how we make a living, by finding amazing people. Whether you're young or female or male, that doesn't matter. It really doesn't. What's important is, why are people reading your LinkedIn profile, reading your CV, and not calling you? Mm-hmm. That's it. That's what happens. Or why are people not finding your CV or your LinkedIn profile? Do you have the right keywords, etc.? It's working on yourself. That's really the most important part. There's no website, or, you know, I could easily promote my agency, but that's wrong. That's a lie. There's no special place. It's just, sorry.
No, but that's useful information in itself. Now, we have had a number of people asking to connect with you, but I've asked you this in the past and your answer's always been the same.
Yeah.
Which is, save your money and buy the book instead.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So lastly, what's the name of the book and where can people find it, Hamza?
The 30 Days Job Search. It's not just a book. It's 25 years of experience in headhunting and knowing what HR look for and what recruiters, how recruiters work. And it's complete. And it's someone that has lost her job in Dubai, and it's the story of this person about to be, you know, she's going to have to leave Dubai if she doesn't have a job. So it's a really good job, and it's a gold medal winner of the Reader's Favorite as well. So it's really doing well. It's on Amazon.
There you go. If you want details of that, and indeed, Hamza, you can just send me the word book, and I will send you the link. It's there on Amazon. So I like it. You're honest. It's like, save you money with a consultation.
No, listen,
start with the book first.
A coaching experience with me is $2,000 to $3,000.
And a book is...
Read the book. I always say, even on LinkedIn, people find me on LinkedIn and they message me. And I always say, read the book. And if you need me, we'll discuss that after the book. They never come back.
The book's too good. The book is too good. So, Hamza, thank you so much for your time. As I said, if you want details of that book, just send me that word and I will hook you up. It's been an absolute pleasure. We've actually had a number of messages that have touched on topics that we'd like to revisit in the future. So Hamza will be back. Eid is just around the corner, and for many people that does mean a long weekend. So if you're heading abroad, let me know what you're up to. And of course, if you're staying here, we might have some ideas. We're wandering now with Nada. Nada, for anyone who's not familiar with the adventures that you plan for yourself, but obviously for other people as well, can you explain a little bit about the services and the fun that you provide? Tell us more.
Absolutely. So Wander with Nada is all about cultural experiences here in the UAE, whether it's in Dubai, Abu Dhabi or Sharjah. It's about exploring sites that are off the beaten track, interacting with locals and getting to hear the really cool insights and stories that are behind them.
In a nutshell.
In a nutshell.
And what have you got in terms of tours and things that you're working on right now? What can people be kind of getting involved in over the coming days and weeks and even months?
So plenty. I mean, all the tours are still running. And in Dubai, there's the old Dubai walking tour. There's a Dubai landmarks tour for people who want to see the modern marvels, but from a very different perspective. In Abu Dhabi, Sheikh Zayed Grand Mosque, and a full day, even cultural tour. And in Sharjah, another cultural tour that explores both east and west sides of the emirate.
Now, I want to ask you about ChatGPT, because I was having a little play on it last week, because I'd heard about it, but I hadn't actually experienced the site myself and put in questions and prompts and see what came out. And it was somewhat prompted by an article that I read in the Sunday Times, which was a guy who was going to Tbilisi. So it caught my eye because I'd been there last year and I was like, oh, I wonder where he's going to go, you know, kind of validating the experience I'd had. Is he going to do the sulfur baths and will he eat, you know, all of that? And he basically put a AI bot up against a guide on the ground. And it was really interesting in terms of the accuracy that ChatGPT had, which actually wasn't that great. Overall, though, he felt you cannot beat a human's experience for those menu recommendations, for the introducing you to people who can get you the best deals on, you know, whatever souvenir you're looking to buy. So are you worried about your...
My business?
Are you worried about your business because of the bots?
Well, I definitely agree. I think that having a person on the ground is certainly far better still. And I don't think that ChatGPT will ever get to that level just yet. What we basically are seeing now is that it doesn't really have the capacity to do a lot of things. So, for example, you can't book flights or make reservations just yet, but it can provide travelers with recommendations to help them plan their trips, including suggestions for airlines, hotels, and activities. But in the near future, this might change, right? So, for instance, what we can do now is you can actually tell your smartphone, I want to travel to Dubai for 5 days in the first week of November. What do you think I should do? And they will actually spit out this incredible list of suggestions, very detailed, and recommendations, but they won't get you to the, let's say, airline page or to the hotel so that you can actually book a room. So that might evolve in the future.
I'm sure it will be a way to monetize that as well.
Oh, yes. And I think that it might, for instance, save a lot of legwork, but it still needs to be fact checked, right?
Totally agree. Because I put in something the day which was, you know, from a content writing point of view, I think it's really interesting. And I think that is perhaps something that, as the accuracy improves, people might need to be getting a bit concerned about. And I said, write me a blog post about Dubai with a family. And it said, you know, Dubai is amazing for this, that, and the other. Yeah. And you can go to Dubai Mall where you can even visit an indoor ski slope. And I was like, No, you can't.
That's not there. Yep. So if you actually do read some of the text that they do provide, it tends to be a little dry. And I've, you know, personally, when writing, I find that putting a personal, let's say, touch or message or even just humor always just relates better with people.
Totally.
So that's why I don't think we're there yet. But, you know, in the future, hotels, attractions, they might even cut jobs just when AI is introduced, right? So reducing the front desk staff if they can. I personally had an experience actually in New York at a hotel called the Yotel. I don't know if you've heard of it. It's a worldwide chain. And I remember going into the lobby and basically there's a computer right there that you are checking in with. And they will actually provide you with your hotel key and then you just, you know, go up to your room. I personally felt that it was just so dry, kind of lacking.
Impersonal.
Exactly. And I wanted to have that human experience. I wanted someone to just greet me and say, hello, welcome, you know, to this place. And here's a list of recommendations of things we think you'd like. And I felt like it missed that.
It's interesting because we were talking about this actually on the Business Breakfast about a month ago, because Jumeirah Hotels, now you can check in with your mobile phone. Well, that's an option too.
Mm.
And I think that's really key, because my husband would prefer to check in online, much like you do, you know,
with an airline
and kind of smooth that process. And, you know, it'd be a case of, you know, here's your code, collect your key. Whereas I'm more like you. I would prefer to see someone and have that eye contact and have someone be able to answer any questions I might have about being what's in the area, or can you do X, Y, Z for the room? So I think, to me, when we're thinking about what luxury means, it means different things to different people. And I think choice is really key. So I'm with you. I like that human interaction, but I think there could be an element of perhaps smoothing
the process. Absolutely, the process.
With a bit of tech.
I would also worry that unethical companies can actually use ChatGPT as fake review forms.
Totally.
Right?
Good
so
point.
It's still uncharted waters for all of us. And I think that there's a lot to consider, but things seem to be moving at lightning speed. So I think it's better to kind of catch up before you're left behind.
Watch this space. Wander with Nada is in the studio. So where are we wandering to over the long weekend? Ida's around the corner. I'm not travelling. Are you travelling, Nada?
I am not.
I'm okay with it. I think, and I don't want to jinx it, but the weather's pretty gorgeous right now.
Yes.
So I want to enjoy it. I think it's going to be a lovely weekend. But it is, for many people, even, you know, 4, maybe 5 days. So we're going to be talking about what we can do. Now, it's the last few days of Global Village. We're coming up to the end of the season. I'm a massive Global Village fan for mostly the food, to be honest. What about you? What are some of your favorites?
So, oh, plenty. I mean, food included. The pavilions themselves. I mean, we're talking about countries that showcase their best, you know, products, souvenirs, antiques. So there's really just about everything. And I just want to emphasize, this is a village or a festival that is not new. It's been around for years. And it's actually closing down very soon on April 30th. So if you haven't already, I would highly recommend going. It's got such an energy that I swear is just unmatched. You could just go and spend hours without even keeping an eye or track of the time. Mm-hmm. And it's just, it's got live performances, caricatures, carnival games. You've got, again, like the food stalls. You've got an incredible food market, which is separate. And stalls actually offer everything from stuffed vine leaves to mac and cheese. So definitely arrive hungry.
Oh,
the delicious aromas
definitely alone
will have you lured.
Flat shoes, stretchy trousers.
Yes.
Top two essentials for Global Village.
I agree.
I always used to go and have Bosnian house kebab because it's one of my favourites. But interestingly, it's opened really close to my house. And I think a lot of food companies actually use Global Village as a bit like in other parts of the world, you'd have a food truck as a kind of a lower priced way of getting into the market.
So yeah, it's way great to test the grounds.
Yeah, it's like as a bit of a launch pad.
Yeah, and a few noteworthy actually pavilions. So Africa, for sure, just for all the Shea butter that you can actually layer on, and these very nice colorful print t-shirts.
Also baskets, my laundry baskets from the African pavilion.
Ah, there we go, another.
And I went at the end of the season, and I would say this, guys, if you want a bargain, it is a case at the end of Global Village, everything must go. So it's a really good time to haggle even harder.
So go in the last few days, yes. In particular. Turkey was also wonderful, beautiful souvenirs, especially jewelry and
Turkish
coffee
towels.
Cups.
Oh, I always buy Turkish towels.
Yep. And I would also say Iran for the best saffron ice cream and Falooda dessert that I've had in Dubai yet.
Ooh.
Big words.
Global Village. We'd love to get... Do you know what, guys? I think we'll do a little bit more on Global Village before it closes, because I always love your recommendations. If you've got any shout-outs now in terms of pavilions or where to eat, 4001. Emirates Biopharm is somewhere that's been on my list for the longest time, and I still haven't...
Have not been.
Still haven't made it.
Yep.
And I would love to, because... Looks like tractor tours and picking, and they've got some things happening over the weekend as well, right?
Yep, and especially for the kids. So it is the largest privately owned organic farm in the UAE, and it's not just about growing and selling vegetables. It is part restaurant, social club, mindful market. And for the 3D Eid, they're hosting an earth-to-table brunch where you can get ingredients that are grown on the land, chemical-free. They've got the farm tractor tours where visitors of all ages can learn about organic and sustainable farming, and they can even harvest their own vegetables. There are chickens and goats roaming around the farm that visitors can feed. And they also have pot coloring sessions. So you can actually buy the pots, and they provide the brushes and the colors, which you can get to take home along with the potting soil and seeds to grow something in your own backyard.
Oh, that sounds lovely.
Yep.
Okay, my husband's currently, do you know what? He's just arrived from the Arctic Circle about half an hour ago. Ah. He's going on like a husky sledding trip. He's taken himself off for his birthday, not for his birthday, it was a birthday in October, but this was his birthday treat to himself. So I'm flying solo with the kids over, and I was like, that actually would be perfect.
What an adventure.
Yeah, so he flew into Oslo. He's had two nights in the city, and then he's literally just got on a plane to go up to Alta in the north of Norway. And he's going to this place. It's called... Let me see if I can find it on Instagram. It's owned by a husband and wife team.
Okay.
And it's a bit of a homestead. So he does all the cooking, pizza, catching fish, all of that. And she runs the dog yard, has all the huskies. And then so for the next 6 days, he's going to be going all kind of around the area, staying in different lodges with his husky pack. So he's going to be, you know, feeding his dogs.
That's amazing.
So it is called... Trusty and Trini, or Trusty og Trini. I will, if anyone wants it, just send me the word Norway and I'll send you the link on Instagram. But prepare to feel very jealous indeed.
Oh,
of Mr.
I have
Farmer
to look at those
photos. Beautiful. Oh. So I've told him he's not allowed to come back without some serious souvenirs. Yeah, big time. Big time. So yeah, I'm looking for things over the weekend, and I have to say, that sounds absolutely lovely. Emirates Biopharm. Okay,
and there's, plenty others also. For instance, there is the Theatre of Digital Arts, and this is at Medina Jumeirah, and they're currently hosting an exhibition called Banksy 360, Art of the Rebel. Now, ooh, it's a 30-minute digital show that shows the mystery artist's graffiti and street art, which are known to be satirical and anti-establishment. So for those of you that actually don't know him by name, he is the artist behind The Girl with the Balloon, and also the one behind The Prank, where one of his paintings was shredded live just as it was sold for $1.4 million.
Nerve-wracking watching,
I know,
that. It made my
anxiety
stomach turn massively. Yes. So that's on at Theatre Digital Art, and that's at Madinat Jumeirah.
Yes. So they just have a nice short 30-minute show, and it shows 50 of his works, which he often puts in the public space, and that's to take art out of its public or typical home, yeah, at museums. Better out than in is his motto. So there's fantastic music as well as some background on the mystery man who paints the towns. The show is 30 minutes and can be booked online or on site. It's also on The Entertainer, so you can actually get two for one.
Good to know. There you go. We've got time. I want to hear a bit more about what you're up to, because you've got some scavenger hunts and tours going on. Tell us about the scavenger hunt, because I think this sounds really fun.
Yeah. So this is a blend of walking food tour, mobster movie, and scavenger hunt all in
mobster
one.
Mobster movie?
Yes.
What?
So myself and A Frying Pan Adventures have designed this game, and a necklace has disappeared, believed to have been stolen by a mob, and it's up to you agents to retrieve it. So agents either play together or they compete. and they have to actually follow cryptic instructions on their mobile phones that lead them on a fixed route to historic sites, souks, and restaurants where they eat mysterious food and identify the ingredients.
Mysterious food.
And, I mean, it's honestly, it's a fantastic game and great fun. It's self-guided, so you can actually pick the day and time within a certain frame, and it's played straight through the mobile phone. So it is that easy. It takes about 4 hours. It's 110 dirhams per player, and we've got an Eid special going on with 15% off until Sunday.
What kind of group size would you recommend, Nada, for the scavenger hunt, and how do you pick your team well in order to win?
So I would say up to four per team. That way it keeps it easy. And in terms of how you pick your fellow agents, well, how dedicated they are. I would say how, for instance, diligent they are about picking their food. Before they go to restaurants, I would always, always, myself, look up the menus. I'll pick exactly.
Do you do that?
Of course.
Oh, my
and then
husband
I'll
does
go
it.
To the
I'm
restaurant.
I'm not going to lie, it drives me crazy. I'm like, can you not just have a little bit of surprise in your life and sit down for dinner with me? And he's like, I know what I'm looking at.
I just want to know. I want to read up. I want to know what's the best thing just so I don't waste the meal. So yes, I'm that type.
What are you going to be doing over the weekend, Nada? What are your own plans?
Work, work, work. Honestly.
It's are you
just,
really?
Yes. Yeah, so the weather is just still so fabulous. So there's plenty outside to do and plenty of tours that people have signed up for.
With the Modern Marvels tour, that was something I think my dad in particular would really enjoy. Tell us a little bit about how it is. It's a bit of a twist on it.
Yeah, so, it is suited for anyone who wants to see something beyond the obvious. So, obviously, anyone can go to Dubai Mall, see the Burj Khalifa, but you really tend to follow the same track that everyone follows and take the same photos, even. So, the idea is, how do you go about it a different way? I've selected very key locations that are, you know, some around those modern places. But the idea is understanding more, for instance, about the architecture, about the line of thinking, the sort of canvases that some of these, planners, artists have thought of when putting these beautiful landmarks together. And I feel like understanding just how important these landmarks are to, you know, the people who live here, the general sort of skyline, that's stuff that people don't really know much about. Mm-hmm. And it's a fun way of learning about the city, but also while seeing all the new modern, you know, marvels.
Tell us more then in terms of getting in touch with you. What's the best way of reaching out and booking a tour or indeed the scavenger hunt you were just talking about as well?
WanderWithNada.com and on social media at WanderWithNada. That's W-A.
Thank you so much. If you want those details, send me the word tour and I will happily connect you. And lots of you asking for the details of my husband's sledding trip. So if you want, yeah, I have to say I'm incredibly jealous. He's got his snow boots on. I think he's missing us a little bit more than
he probably
thought
had to buy a
would.
Whole new wardrobe just
he
for
did.
That trip.
He did.
Right? So, some serious snow boots.
So he's going to have to take me next time because I've still got my stuff from Kilimanjaro. But yeah, if you want to see information on where my husband is spending the next week with the Huskies and the fresh fish and the pizza in Norway, just send me the word Norway and I will send you the link. But I have to say, very jealous indeed. But happy to be in Dubai over the long weekend because I think the weather's going to be amazing. Nada, thank you so much for your time today. Wander with Nada for details of that tour, all of her recommendations and explorations too. This coming weekend, Saturday 22nd, is known as Earth Day, and students at GEMS Education playing their part. They recently took part in a UN water conservation conference. The event was called The Voice of Children and Youth on Water for Sustainable Development, Taking Action for Humanity and the Planet. The conference was held in New York. Students connected online, and two of them are with us now. We've got Thomas and Manan joining us from Jumeirah College. So lovely to have you with us. Have you got out of school early, Manan? No, you finished school because of Ramadan hours now, I guess. So you're 16. What are you doing at school in terms of exams and studies? What stage are you at?
Oh, so we're in year 12, so we have about two more years left of school. And yeah, and then university, so
dun,
we have exams
dun,
approaching.
Are you doing IB or are you doing A-levels?
A-levels.
What are you studying?
I take physics, computer science and math.
Thomas, what about you?
I'm doing economics, math, geography and French.
So let's talk a little bit about the world because no pressure, guys. It's on your shoulders. We've mucked it up and we need your help. Okay, so we're handing over the responsibility and the power to the younger generations. Do you feel, Thomas, pressure on you to kind of take care of the planet? Is this something that a few people have said, whether it's joking like me or, you know, conferences such as this, that, you know, you guys are the hope for the planet?
Yeah, there is a bit of pressure for sure, but again, I feel like the younger generation, they're ready and they're willing to take action. So I think if the younger generation all work together, we can and help save the planet.
Please do. Now, tell us about the UN experience. What was that like, having this conference? Was that pretty nerve-wracking?
It was quite nerve-wracking and exciting, because the UN conference obviously was held from the 22nd of March to the 24th of March in New York. Had over 10,000 participants, companies, NGOs, governments. And we were lucky enough to be given the opportunity by Jumeirah College and the United Nations to present our ideas.
Oh my gosh. Okay, so what were you discussing exactly?
So it was a water conference about water conservation. So we talked to schools from all around the world, from Bhutan to Germany, and the different problems each country faces in terms of water conservation. So like, if I draw a parallel, if you take the UAE and Bhutan, the UAE's problem is not having enough water or natural water, whereas Bhutan's is having a lot of water but not having the infrastructure to supply it to the people who need it.
That's really interesting, because there's never going to be a one-size-fits-all solution, because we've got all these geographical challenges. Tell us a little bit about what you've had in mind for, saving the planet, Thomas. Tell us a little bit about what your kind of big ideas are.
So we had two ideas. We had three goals, actually. So our first goal was to raise awareness about water scarcity, and UAE's goal to reduce individuals' water consumption. Mm-hmm. So to achieve this goal, we had three small objectives. So first of all was to create awareness in school with the Eco Committee students. So we're around 45 students in this committee. And so we're trying to interact with them and doing assemblies. Just talking to them about the water crisis. And me and Manan, actually, we create posters around the school and we put them around the school.
What was on the posters?
What
was the message on the posters?
Well, for the World Water Day, we had a big poster on it. So just to explain what people could do at home and what you can do at home. So like, spend less time in the shower, maybe put like a little timer, because get into the habit of taking showers just less than 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. We had quite a lot of activities that people could do at home.
My daughter, who's 8, is always at me about leaving the water on when I brush my teeth. And she'd be like, "Mum," and then she'll slam the tap down. I'm like, all right. But she's absolutely right. Yeah. It's just habits that you find yourself kind of...
So here comes the younger generation.
Exactly. Yeah. She's coming through. What are some of the practices that you've been doing at home, and that you indeed have been communicating with some of the students, that is really actionable for people listening today?
So some of the stuff we do at home is, like Tom said, reducing our water consumption by taking shorter showers. And in school, for example, we educate the younger years on why water conservation is important and how they can do it too. So there's a whole Eco Committee which students can join, and we have about 45 members right now, and they're all very passionate about this. Mm-hmm. And they all want to know how they can help, and they have many ideas.
Yeah, and adding on Manan, also just... eating more vegetables and less meat. So sorry for the meat eaters, but it requires a lot of water. So just eat a bit more vegetables. You can still eat meat, but just it requires a lot of water. Mm-hmm. And also just buy less clothes and maybe more in secondhand. Mm-hmm.
That's interesting, because when we think about water conservation, we think about that immediate thing. We think of it as being a product that is mm-hmm. scarce, that we touch, that we interact with. But as you're saying, kind of, we think about food supply chain, fashion supply chain, it goes all the way up. But fashion's a really, interesting one in terms of being a massive global polluter. And obviously, think about the amount of landfill. But to even create the cotton of the dress that I'm wearing now, it doesn't even cross my mind. So being a bit more conscious with our consumption.
Yeah.
And what else are we seeing here in the UAE? Are there any initiatives that we could be learning a little bit more about, or that you've kind of noticed around?
Yeah, so as you know, the UAE has a hot desert climate. So fun fact, we don't have a lot of water.
Yeah, we're on the back foot a bit here, guys.
Yeah, we don't have a lot of natural water. So we rely on desalination to get most of our water. So they desalinate 1.3 billion liters of water every year. And what the UAE is doing to play their part, because obviously desalination is a really energy extensive process. Mm-hmm. They're recycling 80% of the wastewater per year. And it has a few goals it wants to meet by 2036. So the first one is bumping up that 80% to 95%. And the other two goals are to do with reducing average water consumption per person by half and reducing their reliance on natural groundwater, which we don't have a lot of.
Through some of the research that you've done in this project, and indeed just, you know, being plugged into to the planet, is this something you think you'd pursue in terms of career goals, or do you want to work with the environment anyway, Manon? Have you got anything kind of up your sleeve for post A levels?
Yeah, so this actually links very well to the course I want to go to. So I want to go into computer science in university, and obviously me and my computer science teacher, Mr. Del Cruz, always talk about like AI and how it's an upcoming thing and how it impacts the environment. So definitely if in the future I can go into a field where we can link AI and the environment, that would be great.
Watch the space. What about you, Thomas?
Me, it's a bit the same, but with economics. So, because I'm studying geography, I have two sides, so physical geography and human geography. Mm-hmm. And so I just feel like it's really interesting. And then with the water crisis and all this, I feel like if I could use my geography and economics knowledge on just talking about it and doing research, and especially for developing countries in Africa or even here in the Middle East, I feel it'd be very useful.
It's really interesting to think about when we think about, you know, climate crisis and, you know, migrants because of climate change. There is a huge opportunity there for companies, yeah, and, you know, individuals to, you know, really make an impact and also make a lot of money as well. So I think the environment's going to be plugged into all sorts of different sectors, whether that is, you know, sustainability in law, education, you know, finance, economics. So, yeah, guys, thank you so, so much. Really interesting to hear what's been happening kind of on the ground. And yes, I will listen to my daughter when brushing my teeth. We've had Thomas and Manon with us this afternoon speaking to us from Jumeirah College. If you've got any young person in your life who's doing something special, they've got a message to share, we'd love to hear from them. You can always contact us on 4001. You've got the ARN Play app. If you've been going through a bit of a rough patch with your partner, haven't been seeing eye to eye, counselling may seem like the next step to take. And it's not a bad idea to give it a shot. But don't feel bad if therapy isn't helping, because according to therapists, there are some instances where couples counselling just won't work. We're delving into this today, indeed, talking about who should be getting marriage counselling and some of the situations where it might just be past the point of help. Dr. Thuraya joining us, clinical psychologist from the Human Relations Institute and Clinic. Dr. Thuraya, lovely to have you with us. How are you?
I'm well, Helen. How are you doing?
I'm really good, thank you. Now, before we delve into marriage counselling, I wanted to ask you about something that you posted on Instagram yesterday. And we've spoken before about how many of us, myself included, expect our partners to be a mind reader and then are disappointed, upset, angry when they're not. And you flag that this is the case in therapy too. Therapists are not mind readers. Can you explain a little bit more and why that's perhaps particularly pertinent on today's show?
Well, essentially, one of the things that we see quite a bit, and it's not done intentionally or with malice at all, but some, you know, naturally when you're seeing a therapist and you're kind of feeling any sense of shame or any sense of embarrassment to talk about certain things, or maybe you're not even aware of certain things, you won't necessarily share them with your therapist or with a partner or with a friend. And one of the things I think that people struggle with when they go to therapy is that they think that the therapist can kind of like read through their mind and telepathically kind of get information from them, which is not accurate at all. We base a lot of the information and a lot of the analysis that we do and the you know, the interventions that we implement on the information that we are given from the clients themselves. And so if they don't share things with us, it's hard for us to actually help them in the way that they're looking for. And that happens in, as you mentioned, in relationships as well, because with couples, if we don't have that proper effective communication where we're sharing what's on our mind, then the other person is not going to know whether or not they need our help, whether or not they just want us to, we want them to listen, and so on and so forth. So if we're not communicating our needs, it becomes very complex for people to actually give us what we're looking for.
I remember when I first started going to some counseling, I had a bit of a tough time about 10 years ago. And I'd, you know, done my research and I'd found someone that had been recommended by someone that I really trusted and went through and sat on her chair and she was, how are you? I was like, I'm fine. And basically told her I was fine for about half an hour. And I was like, I'm paying quite a lot of money to tell someone that I'm fine when I'm really not. So it was a massive waste of time and money. And I think I understand. I also wanted to feel like I was a bit of an easy case. Oh, yeah, you know, she's great. She's clearly fine. So clearly not fine. If you and I felt like I did myself and indeed that session a bit of a disservice by not being, you know, open. So that was an expensive lesson, let's just say. Let's talk marriage counselling. And we're seeing therapy more and more on, you know, in media, you know, in movies, social media as well. And I definitely think this is going some way to normalise it. But I'm kind of curious about marriage counselling in particular, because I feel like there's still a stigma around it, for one thing, but also a lot of mystery around it as well. Mm. So I wondered if you could start in the most basic way of explaining, what does marriage counselling do, Dr. Thryer?
Well, essentially what it does is it gives couples tools that they need to kind of understand each other and resolve conflicts, but all, mainly it's how to openly and effectively communicate with each other.
That sounds amazing. So you sit in front of you and you fix us. Is that right?
Oh God, no, 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 no.
<Go on. laughs>
There's no such thing.
But it's interesting to think that, you know, that presumably is what a lot of people want. You know, that we're going to pay a certain amount of money and dedicate a certain amount of time to be in that room on that sofa, and that person is there to facilitate the mending or the building or the improvement of a relationship, and then that's all you need to do. Presumably there's an awful lot of work that happens outside of that room as well.
Of course. I mean, you know, I say this the same way I do with my couples as with my individual clients. I tell them, if you think therapy happens inside this office, you're extremely misguided on what therapy actually is. Therapy happens outside of the office. Mm-hmm. But the office hour is to kind of check in, give tools, give resources, talk through things, raise insight, raise awareness, so that you can utilize all of that information outside in your day-to-day life and actually implement the therapy that you require for yourself and for your couple. So in marriage counseling, what you're actually doing inside the session, and the first thing that we usually highlight is that marriage counseling does not mean that you're going to stay together. Sometimes marriage counseling means that you're going to actually separate. But what you're going to do is do it amicably in a way that is, I mean, to our best ability, we try our best to get people to leave or stay, but with respect and with compassion towards each other. But in a marriage counseling session, one of the things that's really key to understand is that the work that you're doing in that 1 hour is definitely not enough to work through all of the marriage difficulties. You need to take what's being done inside the therapy session and apply it on a day-to-day basis outside of the session.
Dr. Thryer is with us this afternoon. Talking relationships this afternoon with Dr. Thryer, clinical psychologist at the Human Relations Institute and Clinic. And I'm curious, Dr. T, do we have any data, any stats on just how successful marriage counselling is? How do we define that it's, quote unquote, worked?
Okay, so interestingly, when we look at the statistics that are out there, what we find is that couples who undergo counseling before their wedding, and this is something I always recommend, actually had 30% higher marital success rate than those who didn't.
Okay. I think there's a few things to unpack there. And I agree with you for what it's worth. Not that I did it myself, but I think, you know, it would be hugely beneficial for couples to have some big chats before, you know, the wedding ring goes on the finger. But clearly these are people who are open to this, open to therapy,
right. You
know, open to communicating and recognizing where there might be a problem. So they're already going to be in a good way, hopefully, in terms of having a quote unquote successful relationship. But what about when it doesn't work? And as much as I'd love you to spill the beans on some past clients and lift the lid on what's happened in your room, I wondered, are there any issues that marriage counselling simply cannot fix, or indeed any red flags that you'd be looking out for as a psychologist? Do you think this isn't going to work?
For sure. I mean, I would say definitely when partners come in and we notice that one person already has like one foot out the door, where basically they're coming in, but they've really decided that the relationship is not going to work and it's really hard for them to change their mind, that we can always tell that the relationship is going to be either very difficult and the marriage counseling is going to take a very long time, or it may not necessarily succeed in the way that they want it to. Mm. If partners have different agendas, So, you know, what we're looking for is that we can find a commonality between both. So not everybody's going to agree with each other, and we know that, and that's absolutely fine. But if we can find some common ground, some movement forward, some, you know, points that will take them in a future direction together. But if everybody's coming in with their own agenda and are not willing to listen to the other person, that one, that can be very detrimental as well. Mm-hmm. When there's lack of respect, I mean, you know, we both love Gottman very much. So anytime there's contempt in the relationship, when you hear this severe lack of respect or lack of accountability in the relationship, that can, that doesn't really inspire any kind of solidity in the relationship itself. And if, you know, essentially if there's a lot of abuse, and that could be in many different ways. Mm-hmm. It could be either physical abuse, verbal abuse, emotional abuse, or
financial
abuse.
About a lot recently.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. And so when the relationship itself is imbalanced in any way, and when I use the word imbalance, I want to be careful because I don't want it to seem like, oh, everything has to be equal. No, that's not the case.
But you're talking about kind of controlling behaviors. And,
yes, exactly. Okay. Yes. Okay. And that can actually show itself in therapy as well, because we can actually see it as soon as the first session happens sometimes with how people come in and where they sit and how they sit and who they're facing and what they're doing and what pillows they use and things like that. It's actually quite interesting to read that body language, especially off the bat in the first session. But there are clear indications that the marital counseling will actually either require more time or it will not necessarily succeed.
Dr. Thurai with us this afternoon. We are going to go to the text line next. You can reach out anonymously if you prefer. You can make up a name. I will never know. Dan has been in touch. I don't know if it's Dan's real name. Saying, interesting timing as I'm leaving Dubai for work and wonder if some therapy for me and my wife before I leave would be beneficial. I'll be away for 3 months and then maybe another stint at the end of the year. She's worried about the impact of my absence on our marriage and our kids. I tend to think that we don't know that there'll be any problems, so why get stressed unnecessarily? So coming back to your point there about people having therapy, couples therapy before they get married, what about before a big life change or change in circumstances?
I think that's so important. And I know a lot of people out there probably be like, oh, she's just trying to promote marital therapy. I'm really not. I mean, I'm a big believer on proactivity versus reactivity. And so when people think of therapy, they think, okay, we have to wait until it's bad enough before we actually get into counseling. Mm-hmm. But the reality is that when it gets to that stage, counseling requires so much more effort and a lot longer than when we are proactively looking at, okay, what are the potential difficulties because of what we're already experiencing, mm-hmm. and how can we minimize its growth? That's essentially what we're looking for.
I had friends that had, and again, I'm going to say couples counseling because they went as a couple, but it wasn't about their relationship. They were leaving Dubai, actually, and they went to speak to a therapist about this change, about, you know, we met here, we built our life here together, and we don't know each other outside of this city and our jobs here. And it was really fascinating to hear what the therapist was talking about, which was effectively, you need to grieve this chapter of your life and say goodbye to it, but also was really helpful in them understanding what expectations were of relocating, of what their identity could look like. And I thought it was, as you say, really proactive and impressive. And, you know, they are together now, I'm happy to say, and happily living somewhere else. So Dan, if that is indeed your real name, Dr. T says yes. No name on this one, saying, do some people use therapy as a place to tell their partner something for the first time and have the therapist act as a mediator? Is that a role of a therapist or not?
Well, I mean, we've definitely seen it time and time again where people will feel more comfortable and sometimes even safe to discuss certain things with their partner, and not safe from like a physical perspective, but emotionally safe or psychologically safe. And yes, that can be the role of the psychologist, where there is something that that one partner would like to share with the other, and they're not really sure how to do so, that the psychologist can then mediate and help both parties have that space to do so.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good take there. Dr. T with us this afternoon. Dr. Thurai, clinical psychologist. We're talking marriage counselling. Dr.
Dr. Thryer, clinical psychologist at the Human Relations Institute and Clinic, joining us this hour to answer my general questions around marriage counselling. Who is it for? When does it work? When doesn't it work? And crucially, taking your questions as well. So if this is something that you're weighing up or something you're struggling with, please get in touch. We're very much here to help, and you can be completely anonymous. Dr. Thryer, Victor's put his name on this message, saying, I think it's an interesting point, saying, as a man, I'd worry about a female therapist siding my wife in disagreements, and I guess maybe vice versa. How can you make sure that doesn't happen?
That's a very good question. That's an extremely good question. And I would say if you have any therapist that sides with one over the other, you actually don't have a good marriage therapist. So marriage therapists are not supposed to side with one or the other. They're supposed to create a space where both individuals feel like they're being heard without judgment and with care. And it's not about siding. What we're trying to do is just to get the other person to understand. So it's also about both parties understanding that if the therapist is rephrasing and trying to get you to understand something from a different perspective, they're not siding with, they're actually giving you the language that you can understand your partner. However, if you feel that the therapist is siding with, it's important to bring that up in session so that either the therapist can, you know, explain it to you differently, or they could, you know, check themselves and see if they're actually doing that.
Good question, Victor. Thank you. To the text line, anonymous message here saying, my husband tries to avoid me when I talk about a subject he doesn't like, or if I feel he should have handled the situation differently. He probably wants to avoid escalation, but never comes back to that same subject, and it's really frustrating. I've talked to him and said this is annoying me, but no change. What can I do? Communications issues coming in on 40001. Thryer, and I'm not going to say, you know, should this couple have marriage counselling? Because, you know, that's not going to necessarily be the answer for everybody for myriad reasons. But what advice, if this was to come into your clinic, do you think you'd be offering?
Well, I think the first thing to do is check with yourself and ask yourself, am I actually giving my partner a safe space for them to openly communicate? Because at times we don't recognize that when our partner is speaking to us, we might get defensive, we might stonewall, you know, we might use what Gottman refers to as the four horsemen of the apocalypse. So what we want to first see is, are you giving him the safe space? And if you are honest with yourself and you actually are giving him the safe space, then it would be interesting to approach this topic and say, okay, listen, what would you need from me in order to have this conversation in a way that doesn't feel like it can escalate? Mm-hmm. So asking him for his needs first before approaching the topic, and then seeing how that works and moving forward from there.
Okay, thank you for that. A message from a male listener saying, my wife's therapist, who she's seeing for her mental health and well-being, said she can meet me only with her permission. And also, if I want to fix the marriage, I'd requested for divorce mediation and counsel for co-parenting. The therapist refused because my wife is not in agreement. How is the therapist helping?
So this is where it gets a little bit tricky. Essentially, if a therapist is an individual counselor to one partner, they cannot see both partners at the same time. So if, let's say, I have a client and my client's husband would like to join the sessions, I could probably see them for one session and then refer them to a marriage therapist. But I cannot see the individual as well as the couple themselves. This is against all of our code of conduct. However, because it's a conflict of interest. So if I have a client who is the individual and the husband requests to see me, I cannot see them without the permission of my client because my client is the individual and not the actual couple themselves. Okay. However, what I can do if the husband is reaching out to me, I can share that with my client and say, listen, this is what they're recommending. What do you think? And then if the client refuses, there's not really much that I can do because my hands are tied because my client is actually the individual and not the couple themselves.
Okay. Thank you. That does make sense. That's actually really interesting because I wanted to ask you about when should you seek individual therapy instead or indeed before couples counselling. So we've had a number of messages, you know, where, you know, it feels like, you know, it's a me problem or it's a they problem. So what about someone comes into clinic and you might go, do you know, I actually should probably see you both? Or can you work with somebody to get them to a point where actually couples counselling might be more beneficial?
Well, usually what happens is it depends on how they're coming in. So essentially, if they come in as an individual and I realize that marital counseling might be beneficial, what I will do is I'll refer them to a marital therapist as well. And so I'll see that client as well as the marital therapist will see them as a couple. However, if I see them as a couple and then I realize there's a lot of individual work that needs to happen, what I will do is I will continue working with them as the couple, but I will also strongly recommend that each one of them sees their individual therapist to work on their issues that are being brought into the marriage, but are not necessarily marital difficulties.
Okay. Oh, okay. Okay. That makes sense. A message from R saying, how can counseling help couples develop trust and rebuild their relationship after a betrayal? I don't know.
Oh, that's a very good question. And actually, you're going to love me, Helen, because I'm going to give you something that I just saw recently, which is a phenomenal TED Talk by a professor from Harvard. Her name is Frances Frey.
Okay.
And she talks about rebuilding and building trust, not just with people, but also in a relationship. And it's very interesting because she talks about the three components of trust. But in a relationship, when we have, you know, whether it's infidelity or whether it's betrayal in one way or another, and that could be anything, it could be financial betrayal, it could be betrayal with in-laws and so on and so forth. What we're looking to do is rebuild consistency. We're looking to rebuild transparency and authenticity within the relationship, mm-hmm. and allow the both partners to see consistency so that they can move forward from the betrayal. And, you know, a lot of individuals think, okay, if there's, like, let's say, infidelity in the relationship, then that's the ending of the relationship. That's not correct, because sometimes, and you know this because I know you love her too, Esther Perel actually talks about how an infidelity can create a much better relationship than the relationship you used to have before.
That's interesting. So consistency, so it's, I mean, yes, of course, listen to what I've got to say, but also watch what I'm doing and doing again.
Right.
Again. So I've just had a little Google. It's 15 minutes. Frances Frey is spelled Frei. How to Build and Rebuild Trust TED Talk. Some evening viewing. I've got a message here. He says, going by the name of Zach. Thank you, Zach, for getting in touch. Saying, my wife, this is just a big one. My wife on multiple instances has purposefully scratched and slapped me. She's always mentioned that she's got very impatient and angry and that she will work on it. She's currently taking solo sessions with a therapist. What can I do to firmly believe her and ensure it doesn't happen again? Or is it something that will keep happening when things get bad? So abuse, we were just talking about that, and this listener's wife is seeking help, but it sounds like we just said it. There's no trust that this isn't going to happen again. What can this listener do? And is it something that they could do together potentially to rebuild that trust?
Well, I think first and foremost, you have to remember that as humans, we make mistakes. And so essentially, even if we are getting help for the issues that we're experiencing, it doesn't mean that help is going to happen right now in this moment. It doesn't mean that it's never going to happen again. But what you're looking for is consistent behavioral change of trying, that they're doing their best in every way possible and they're seeking help, but they're also engaging in and committing to small changes that might be helpful for them in those moments. So there might be a chance that the anger bursts come out again. It's just a matter of, what are you noticing outside of that? Are you noticing that there are other changes that are contributing to calm? And is it as frequent as it used to be? Is it in the same way that it used to be? So you don't want to focus on the outcome of it never happening again, because mm-hmm. that's not humanly possible. But what you do want to see is that are these instances happening, you know, less frequent, with less intensity, and you're actually visibly seeing change that the person is actually working on.
Thank you, Thraya. I wanted to ask you about strategies for preventing relapse, for want of a better word, or indeed maintaining progress after marriage counselling. You know, do you get to a stage where you go, do you know what, guys, you are free, I'm releasing you into the wild, you know, our work here is done. And again, that's not about, you know, you are fixed and there's no more work to be done outside of the therapy room. But what about maintaining that progress? What do you tend to advise couples in their last session with you?
One of the things that I highlight with them is almost like a summary. And I say, what are the tools that you now have that you didn't have before that you can use for yourself moving forward? And so I want to see that they have recognized what those tools are. And I think that's really important because, you know, like you said, Helen, we're always going to experience problems in our life. But we need to recognize that through therapy, we learn different tools that we can then implement in those situations. Mm-hmm. So the ending to a marriage counseling sessions is basically that you have the tools, you've been implementing them consistently, and you know what they are, and now you're going to go out and use them whenever you need them.
Dr. Thurai, thank you so much. A really, really enlightening discussion, to be honest. And judging by the number of messages, and apologies if we couldn't get to yours, we will absolutely revisit this topic because it has definitely flagged a few behaviours that I'm sure Dr. Thurai can speak to. Dr. Thurai, I really appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Helen.
It's been a pleasure. And you can find Dr. Thurai at the Human Relations Institute and Clinic. She's a clinical psychologist. They work there with children, teens, couples, as we've just been discussing. If you want the details of the clinic, just send me the word talk and I will send you the link. And thank you for downloading this episode of the Afternoons with Helen Farmer podcast. Don't forget, you can subscribe. You'll get direct to your phone as soon as it's out. And you can listen to me live on Dubai Eye 103.8, Monday to Friday between 2 and 5 p.m.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.